Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and I'm so excited to present to you Jim Emke. Again, I really loved all you taught us about nutrition and the body and the organs the other day. That was so wonderful, and I'm very excited to talk to you again about whatever we get into. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
I'm really glad you're back. And so I wanted to talk about a myriad of things, of course, but I wanted to start talking about, I called it mental health or emotional health. We've got a country that's just loaded with depressed people, and I wondered if we could maybe talk about that.
Let's talk about that. That sounds like a good subject.
Yeah.
Be pertinent, and as you indicate, it's a virtual, you know, epidemic in our culture.
It really is, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So
you want me to begin?
I do. I want to know how you look at that kind of thing. I know it can be a complexity of things, so why don't we just pretend
sure.
I've come to you with a depression. How's that?
Well, absolutely. There's a couple of things that I think need to be considered metabolically in those types of situations. One is gut health. Mm-hmm. And we know now that the gut, the human intestinal tract, makes 80% of our serotonin, 80% of our dopamine, you know, the really good feel-good hormones. And we know that hormones are very, very powerful in the body. And, you know, when they're not right, it's hard for the body to function properly. It's hard for the brain to function properly. And gut health, Candace Pert sort of opened the door in the early 90s or mid-90s with her book, Molecules of Emotion, where, you know, stress is a big consideration in this whole theme as well, and it ties right into this. And she was a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health, and her and a colleague discovered how to put tracers on the chemicals released under different emotions.
Ah.
The book is called Molecules of Emotion. It's a classic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Pert, P as in Paul, E-R, T as in Tom. And
she also has it on CD for people who like to listen in the car.
Excellent, even better.
Yeah.
Well, then, so you've heard her CD.
I have, yes.
Well, then please correct me as I continue with this because I might not have every single detail in its proper order.
Here. Oh, okay, I trust you, Jim.
So they found that, to their amazement, that the gut had more receptor sites for these molecules of emotion than any other part of the body except the limbic system. And so it was a shocker. And just as a little anecdote, which doesn't quite relate to our theme today, they found that the spleen has more receptor sites than any other part of the immune system. So these molecules of emotion, and they induced, as I understand it, spontaneous emotions, laughter, happiness, joy, as opposed to depression and despair and despondency and, you know, that kind of thing. And the behavior was so radically different, but their amazement was the gut. You know, they were shocked. But then she said, well, you ever have a gut feeling? You ever get a lump in your throat when you're upset or you're crying or whatever? Some people, when they're stressed, they eat, and some people, when they're stressed, they can't eat. You know, the gut is clearly involved.
Mm-hmm.
But little did they know then what's known now about all the, you know, probiotic organisms in the gut that generate, you know, neurohormones and neurotransmitters. And now we're finding out that the gut has this tremendous relationship with the heart and heart disease and cancer. And, you know, in the old-time naturopaths, in fact, my first mentor, V.E. Irons, they were all into you start with the gut. You clean the gut. You heal the gut. You replenish the gut. And that will take care of your body to a large extent. And that was my personal experience, actually, when I healed myself of the boils and the problems I was having with summer asthma and stuff like that by detoxifying and cleaning and, you know, improving gut function. Now we see that the ramifications are dramatic.
So if I come to you with depression, do you give me an enema? Is that it?
Well, I would put you on a cleansing program. And that would include enemas and colonics and detoxification techniques at that level, the gross level. Absolutely. I'd replenish you with probiotics. I mean, I work with people that, you know, have a bowel movement once a week. The longest is every 3 weeks.
Hmm.
It's quite profound. And I, you know, in the class that I teach at the co-op here locally in Bellingham, I have a quote from a physiology textbook that was used at the University of Wisconsin when my wife and I studied there. And in this book, they say that you can go, you know, up to, you know, I've read it so many times, I should have pulled it out so I can read it verbatim here, but it's something to the effect of in unusual cases where elimination has been prevented for a year or more, blockage of the rectum No ill effects were noted from blockage of the rectum except for discomfort. And then it goes on to say, in unusual cases where elimination has been prevented for a year or more, I'm serious. I mean, this is the reason I read it in class, is because it sure wakes everybody up and gets everybody's attention. Anybody slouching in their seat is suddenly paid attention. Like, for a year or more, by blockage of the rectum, no ill effects from accumulated feces were noted except for the discomfort of carrying around an extra 50 to 100 pounds.
Wow.
No matter. And this is a quote from a physiology textbook. It was used at the University of Wisconsin. It was written at the University of Michigan, and it was used throughout the United States.
But isn't it interesting, because anybody who's been constipated for any length of time will report a whole lot of interesting feelings of misery and frustration and headaches and, yeah.
I mean, here's where common sense and science, just don't jibe.
Interesting, yeah.
So the gut is number one as far as I'm concerned. If you don't have the right types of neurohormones and neurotransmitters, being produced in the intestinal tract, how can you possibly have a healthy relationship with the mind-brain, kind of like link here?
Right.
So to me, that's a very, very important consideration. And if it isn't addressed, you can spin your wheels for a long time, taking antidepressants and different medications and supplements and amino acids. And they're all fine at some level. I'm particularly fond of some of the nutrients at that level. But you never really turn the corner.
Yeah, that's really true. It's very interesting. I wanted to throw one more thing in, because as you know, I'm an intuitive. And one of the things I've learned about the spleen is that is a really intense empathy organ. So that would throw a whole other emotional level in there, because you mentioned the spleen, right?
Yes. Thanks for mentioning that. I never heard that. I know that in Chinese medicine, as I understand it, the spleen is the mother and the liver is the father. I think that's a general acupuncture kind of a concept.
Ah.
But the spleen is the lost organ of Western medicine. I mean, how many, there's almost no focus on the spleen at all. Candace Pert called the spleen, in her book Molecules of Emotion, she called it the brain of the immune system, because it had more receptor sites for these molecules of emotion than any other part of the immune system.
Oh, wow.
And the spleen and the thymus is where a lot of the blood cells, the white cells, lymphocytes, and T cells and the like incubate. They're made in the bone marrow, but they're incubated in the spleen and the thymus, and that's where they sort of develop. So it's a very important organ, even though, in the West we don't give much thought to the spleen. So to me, gut health is a beginning point. And I should also mention Gershon's book, G-E-R-S-H-O-N, Gershon. He's a medical doctor, and he followed up on Candace Pert's work, and he wrote a book called The Second Brain. The Second Brain.
Okay.
It's absolutely classic. It's everything you want to know about the gut and how it affects your mental and emotional well-being and the function of your brain, the book is terrific. You can get it anywhere, Amazon, whatever. The Second Brain by Gershon, fantastic book. And those two books are the classics in the field as far as I'm concerned.
Wow. I wonder about research on the gut and things like schizophrenia. I know I'm kind of going farther afield, but I think there must be a huge tie-in, hey?
Yeah, I don't think you're going far afield here, because really schizophrenia fits right into the subject. And I've never seen anything specific about schizophrenia, but I can't imagine that it wouldn't be a factor. As far as the brain and the mental process malfunctioning because of chemical imbalances, I think it fits right into that.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned in our preliminary conversation that you were familiar with Hoffer's work, and he used B3, vitamin B3, niacin, to treat schizophrenia, correct?
Mm-hmm. He sure did. And he had some really good results. Now, I don't remember ever reading anything that he wrote about the gut, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But his results, you and I talked about how some really hate the flush that comes from B3.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I found, I told you that I had gone through a big critical time in my life where I really came undone. And when I got into doing all this research on health foods and so on, I was really miserable one night, and I started typing a letter to a friend about how down I was. And I had popped my vitamin B3, my niacin, at the beginning. And as the flush hit, I was writing saying, oh, yeah, things are really hard. I don't know when I'm ever going to get my act together, and I'm having a really wonderful time, and I'm going out, and I'm meeting some new people. It was just like as the flush went through me, my brain went way into a whole different way of being. It was so clinically obvious. You know, if somebody had been snapping my brain at the time, mm-hmm. we would have had a wonderful example of what kind of things happen, you know?
Yeah, well, and B3 is therapeutic in other ways as too. What was your dose, if I might ask?
I think I was up to 1,500.
Yeah, that's a significant dose. For those who are listening and want to experiment with niacin, I'd suggest starting at 100 milligrams.
And the other thing we talked about is people don't like the flush because it can seem really scary. You feel like your whole body is coming apart. But why I took it and really liked it, I was going through a lot of like research and personal changes. And the first time I took it, I ripped my clothes off and looked in a full-length mirror and watched the red go right up through my skin.
Uh-huh.
But I also had learned that flush also exercises little lazy capillaries to the brain, to the heart, to all of the organs. So I found myself much more able to tolerate the discomfort, which only lasts about 20 minutes or so.
Right.
You know, sometimes it lasts longer, but mostly it's really short. But if you know what it's doing some calisthenics in there.
Yeah, it definitely opens up capillary circulation, which is, of course, what causes the flush. I once had a client in Chicago who was, and I was living in Hawaii at the time, and, you know, the time zones and everything, and I saw her email and opened it up, and she was going to go to the hospital because she was having a niacin flush and didn't know what it was.
I've heard lots of stories like that. I really love that.
I know, and I called her. I just dropped everything and called her and said, no, you don't need to go to the hospital. You're okay. Just let it pass. It will pass, you know. And some people flush much more than others. But,
and it can make your heart feel, you know, you can really feel your heart, and that scares people too, right?
Yes, but nothing to be concerned about. Now, I was mentioning too, when we were talking earlier, there was a psychiatrist, a Russian psychiatrist in Rockford, Illinois, which is fairly close to Milwaukee, where I practiced for many, many, many years. He used buffered niacin, which is called niacinamide, which is also B3, but it doesn't have the flush. And he was a very popular guy in his day. This goes back to the 70s and 80s, and treated a lot of people with niacin therapy using niacinamide.
Huh.
You mentioned niacin is what Hoffer recommends, and I don't really know. I haven't had enough experience in this field to know if it matters, whether it's niacin or niacinamide. And both are B3, but you don't get the flush with niacinamide. I should also mention, just as an anecdote on the subject of niacin, it's used extensively for lowering cholesterol and triglycerides especially, and it's one of the only substances that's known to raise high-density or HDL cholesterol. And they know now with cholesterol that the lipid particle size is actually the key to understanding the risks associated with cholesterol. And that's why high-density HDL cholesterol has always been considered to be beneficial because it's a large particle, whereas LDL, or low density, is a smaller particle. And then VLDL, which is very low-density lipoprotein, is actually the triglycerides divided by 5, is the smallest particle. So as you go from large to small to very small, the risk factors increase if you have too much of the small particle type cholesterol. And niacin is one of the only substances known that, and niacinamide does not do this, only niacin.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there are distinctions between niacin and niacinamide. Only niacin will actually raise HDL and increase the particle size of LDL and VLDL. It lowers triglycerides, lowers lipids. If it wasn't for the flush, it would be much more popular than statin drugs because it costs about $5 a bottle, you know?
And it's, you know, when you know what the flush is, it really isn't that bad. It's when you don't know what it is and you start to resist it, it's really scary.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. I agree completely. And the other little caveat around this is that the longer you take it, you don't flush at all. Eventually, you don't flush.
But I've been taking it for 40 years off and on, and sometimes you flush like mad even though, which probably tells us that we needed it at that point, hey?
Well, have you been taking it every day for 40 years?
No, not at all. I stop for a year or two, and then I start taking it. Mostly, I start taking it again when I have a lot of sleep problems.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, for people that I don't have much experience using niacin or niacinamide with schizophrenia or conditions like that, but for cholesterol problems, I've got quite a bit of experience with it. And for people that take niacin every day for lowering lipids and raising particle size, et cetera, they stop flushing. I've had a client, and right now I'm just thinking of one person in Madison, Wisconsin, who takes 2,000 milligrams every night at bedtime, doesn't flush at all, been doing it for years. It's done wonders for her you know, lipids and cardiovascular risk and that kind of
thing. Is that ever good news? Wow.
Yeah.
So no statin drugs. Yeah, I think it's. And you know what else? For everybody who's listening, it's really good for your skin. That flush makes your skin beautiful. You know what I mean? It makes sense, doesn't it? Fresh blood to the skin.
Yeah, well, sure. It definitely lights you up.
Don't take it in the sauna.
Well, actually, there are purification and detoxification techniques using saunas, which will have you take like a 2 or 3,000 milligrams of niacin a day while you're in saunas for hours. So they combine niacin with saunas.
Wow. Well, now I think I'd have to really prepare myself for that one.
Yeah, that's actually called the Purif detox, and it's actually promoted big in Scientology. Now, I'm not a Scientologist, but I have no, axe to grind with anybody. And so they popularized it, though. And so people that are into Scientology want to do their detox, they'll go to California, wherever, and they'll take saunas like all day long. I mean, for hours, hot saunas, and they'll be dosing up on niacin so they can just flush and sweat and flush and sweat and have tremendous deep. And people have, I've worked with many clients who've done it who are just absolutely in love with it. They think it helped them tremendously.
Wow. Well, it makes sense, I guess. It makes a lot of sense to be kind of heating yourself up and sending out the toxicity, right?
Well, and the skin is one of the four major routes of elimination in the body. You know, there's only four routes of elimination: the bowels, the lungs, the kidneys, and the skin. And the skin is the biggest, toughest, most resilient organ in the body by far. It's almost never life-threatening, although it can be with melanoma and certain exceptions. But it's a tremendously tough and resilient organ, and it is a primary organ of detoxification. So, utilizing the skin in this way, which is what this obviously what this technique of saunas and niacin does, is, totally logical.
Wow. Well, I'd never heard that before, so thanks for that information. I don't know if I'm going to jump into my sauna with niacin yet.
I'm going to shift gears here unless we're done with you.
Please, no, else? Please, this is fascinating. Anything you want to go to.
Yeah, well, another thing I find that clinically with people that are have depression and fatigue and, those types of symptoms, which can obviously fits into the mental health category. And let's face it, if a person is fatigued enough, chances are they're going to have depression.
Right.
They tend to go hand in hand. Couple of areas come into play. One is the calcium level in the tissues of the body. Obviously, calcium is a very, very important mineral, and it can't be overstated, absolutely essential, but it can be overdone. And when calcium accumulates extensively in the soft tissues of the body, which of course also contributes to plaque because hard plaque is upwards of 90% calcium. When calcium accumulates in the tissues, it has a very suppressing effect, and it especially suppresses thyroid function. I mean, if you're taking thyroid medication and you take it with calcium, you can forget about the effectiveness of the medication. I mean, excess calcium is totally contraindicated with thyroid problems. And in hair analysis is, in my estimation, the best way to measure tissue calcium levels, not blood calcium. Blood calcium is regulated by the parathyroid gland, and it will not allow the blood calcium to vary. The only time you'll ever see, 98% of the time, if you see a problem with blood calcium, it's a parathyroid problem. There are some extremely rare exceptions, but the parathyroid regulates that calcium level for a variety of reasons. Calcium in the blood is so crucial, and the interesting thing is that calcium in the blood doesn't tell you anything about the bones. I mean, a person with severe osteoporosis and even somebody dying of osteoporosis has a normal blood calcium level. So there's
Person dying of osteoporosis, can they have calcium deposits elsewhere in their body?
Sure. Because what happens is the one of the things calcium does in the blood is it helps to maintain the alkalinity of the blood. Blood must be alkaline. Just slightly alkaline, 7.3, 7.4. Just 7 being neutral, and below 7 being acidic and above 7 being alkaline, so just slightly acid. And that's why the blood is salty in the fashion that it is, because that is very important for alkalinity as well. But calcium is a very alkaline substance. And the diet that we consume in the United States, the lifestyle, the stress and the pollution and the diet that's so high in acidic foods, which would be all your flesh proteins, your sugar, your refined carbohydrates, your soda pop, your coffee, all very acidic, and the blood has to be alkaline. So what's the body going to do when all these acidifying agents are coming in from the environment? Well, it will pull calcium from the bones and buffer the acidity. And in the process of calcium resorption from the bones, that calcium is ultimately deposited in soft tissues. So you can definitely develop soft tissue calcium deposits in the process of the body trying to manage pH of the blood by pulling calcium, which then ultimately ends up being deposited. You can see that in a hair analysis because a hair is tissue, and whereas blood is blood and it's regulated, you won't see that process in the blood.
So Jim, if I was living on, and this isn't me, but Coca-Cola and donuts or coffee and donuts, and I took calcium supplements, what would happen?
Well, I don't know that anything would happen that you would notice. I think it would, when people need calcium, it's essential that they get it, but most people don't. The United States, I think, is like third in the world in calcium consumption, yet we lead the world in osteoporosis and osteoarthritis. Mm. So calcium intake isn't really the key. The body's got plenty of calcium in the bones that it can pull for decades if necessary, you know, to use throughout the body in different ways. But if you're eating that kind of a diet, getting back to your specific question of Coca-Cola and donuts, which does just a scary thought, actually.
I know. It's extreme. But I just wondered if the calcium would have any effect at all on correcting the imbalances.
I don't think so. I can't say that absolutely factually, but I doubt it because the calcium, maybe the body would utilize the calcium to deal with some of the, you know, the acidity from that kind of intake. But typically the parathyroid is going to pull calcium to buffer the blood, and that's the way the system works. Maybe your body, if you're calcium deficient, maybe your body can use that calcium, you know, creatively. But if you're not calcium deficient, then you're not going to be able to use it anyway. And the parathyroid, the natural reflex of the parathyroid is to draw calcium from the bones.
Hmm.
And that's really the chemistry of osteoporosis, which is a subject for another day, is the body's trying to deal with the acidity coming in from the environment, and it's depleting the bones to do it.
Hmm.
That is the chemistry. It's not a calcium deficiency disease, and that's why taking calcium doesn't resolve osteoporosis. And I don't want to get too, I don't want to digress too much into osteoporosis, but, taking calcium supplements doesn't reverse osteoporosis.
Right.
There are some types of calcium, specific types that have a better effect than others. And if you combine the calcium with a whole range of support to make sure that it's utilized properly and metabolized and, you know, and delivered to the bones, then you can reverse osteoporosis nutritionally. Absolutely. In fact, in our class, I mentioned Dr. Racine Baker, is it Baker Racine, who, developed a protocol for that, and I have never seen her protocol fail to reverse osteoporosis in a year.
Wow, is that ever encouraging, eh?
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, and osteoporosis is a relative epidemic in our culture these days.
It sure is, isn't it? Well, didn't you say that it came as, it was heralded by the advent of pharmaceuticals?
Could you qualify that a little bit? I don't quite understand the question.
Well, we didn't used to have a lot of osteoporosis, right?
Oh, right, yeah.
We started using a lot of different chemical substances.
Right, and the diet change. I mean, when people live close to the earth and they're eating, you know, vegetables as a primary, foundation of the diet with whatever seasonal fruits and nuts and seeds and gathering and agricultural products and legumes and whole grains and, you know, when people ate that way, there was virtually no osteoporosis. In fact, in England, this was a study that was done, 10 years ago that I saw, and they were digging up an old church. And in those days, you know, going back into virtual ancient times, they buried people in the basement of the churches.
Right.
And they had all these bones to evaluate that were, you know, back from, you know, AD whatever, when, you know, really old bones, and they were all solid. There was no osteoporosis in the bone, you know, density that they studied in these people that lived like farmers on the land, on your feet. There's nothing that enhances bone density as much as weight bearing, meaning standing on your feet, working, carrying the weight of your body. You know, weight is the biggest stimulus for bone density. And
so literally using our bodies.
Using our bodies, being physical, work in the fields. I mean, old people, you know, people that work the land, that was physical.
Yeah.
And in the sunlight, to boot, you know, so you'd have to worry about taking vitamin D supplements because you were seriously tanned by the end of the growing season.
Wow. Well, so now let's jump around a little bit. You were talking about, calcium in the thyroid, and I can't remember exactly what you said, but something...
Well, with relative to depression and fatigue, the mm-hmm. thing that I see the most common, and this is not at all unusual, in hair chemistry is really high calcium levels. Mm-hmm. And calcium can suppress potassium, and when potassium is suppressed, it has a very adverse effect on thyroid function.
Well, apparently candida does as well, does it?
Yes, yeast is another big factor because that's a subject that fits right into this because our culture has become a yeast-dominant culture. We used to have a bacterial-dominant culture, and then antibiotics, ended that. And so, infectious disease, bacterial infections used to be the number one cause of death, in the world and in mm-hmm. the United States. But antibiotics changed that, and so then the natural consequence of overly using antibiotics, which has become the case in the United States, where historically now for the last 10, 20, 30 years, we've way overused antibiotics for things that they shouldn't have been used for, and now we develop resistant bacteria plus yeast, because when you kill beneficial bacteria with antibiotics, it allows yeast to proliferate.
Well, Jim, doesn't our diet, the crazy diet, also kill the beneficial yeast in our gastrointestinal tract?
Well, if it doesn't kill it, the beneficial yeast or the beneficial organisms in general, what are called probiotic organisms, if it doesn't directly kill them, it certainly antagonizes them and does everything possible to weaken their presence. But the antibiotics definitely directly kill or destroy these beneficial organisms.
Right.
And now we live in the yeast culture where so many people have yeast issues. And when you think about what yeast does, it's a very simple organism. It basically metabolizes carbohydrate and produces alcohol and carbon dioxide. That's why they use yeast, of course, in making alcohol products. And so there are people that have so much yeast in their gut that they're literally, when they're eating carbohydrates, they're literally converting those carbohydrates into alcohol and carbon dioxide, and so they have a low-grade alcohol impact in their system, which is very depressing.
I was just going to say that must contribute to the massive depression, huh?
Of course. Absolutely. So, you're brewing your own alcohol, if you will, in your gut, which is the perfect environment, especially once you kill all the beneficials or you really alter or weaken the beneficials with antibiotics and things like that, and that's why in women, but it can happen to men too, but it's not as obvious, with women and their anatomy, women who take antibiotics often end up with vaginal yeast infections.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, it migrates from the gut. I mean, there's really no long-term food supply vaginally for yeast, so it migrates from the intestinal tract, from the rectum, and migrates vaginally. Sets up shop for a while, flares up, and then sort of dies down, but the antibiotics are catalyzed the whole process.
Mm.
So I really think the overuse of antibiotics in our culture has significantly contributed to the depression and the mental disorders and diseases that we have. And if you really study antibiotics, you'll see that there are all sorts of other behavioral and even intellectual consequences of taking antibiotics. It can really impair learning ability and contribute to ADD and ADHD and stuff like that. So it's everything's connected in one way or another. Nothing is really isolated in human biochemistry. Everything affects everything else.
But this whole discussion so far has gotten us back to the gut over and over again. That's really teaching me something.
It is interesting that it has. The gut is the foundation for a healthy body. It just can't be underestimated. Now it's been proven. Now the science is there to establish it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before it was just an old, theory that the naturopaths of yesteryear were strong about, but never really acknowledged in the medical community. And again, that quote from the book that I mentioned, the textbook. And by the way, I have to acknowledge this. I had lost this quote for a while, and then I was looking, I was on Google looking for the textbook, and I noticed that the new editions, the same textbook is still being used in universities, but they've really changed that section on the colon. So, again, to the credit of the scientific community, they realized eventually that was ridiculous. You can't, go a year without a bowel movement, suffer no consequences. You can't carry 50 to 100 pounds of feces in your intestinal tract without any consequence. Come on. So they've changed it. But I still, but it was used throughout the 70s and the 80s. And because my wife has a master's in nutritional science, she was actually supervising somebody that was doing some university work, and Karen was a former instructor at the university, and she had the opportunity she was qualified to supervise this woman's study of physiology, And this was like in the mid-80s, and they were still using the same textbook. I found that interesting.
Wow, isn't that incredible?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so let's go back to Candida just for a minute. What are the symptoms? And I hear this from people all the time. What are the symptoms of Candida? I think, if I'm correct, there's an awful lot of emotional and mental stuff. Is that right?
Oh, sure, because when you're producing alcohol in your system and you're disrupting the normal gut, you know, probiotic environment with yeast, and you're gonna be fatigued and down, and you know, when you're fatigued and down, it has consequences on overall brain chemistry, and you know, depression, lethargy, fatigue, you know, they're all sort of tied together, so the consequences are significant. And I should also mention, which is a bit of a digression here, but Dr. Simoncini, who's an oncologist, a well-known, internationally well-known oncologist from Italy, he found that cancer tumors are loaded with yeast.
Mm-hmm.
Loaded with yeast. And
wow.
He considers cancer to be a fungal condition.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and he uses baking soda to kill the yeast and tumors. And IVs it. You know, he does intravenous baking soda, and he goes right into the artery that feeds that particular organ. Simoncini, he's really Simoncini. Simoncini, I don't know exactly how to spell the name, but I wasn't thinking of talking about him today, so I don't have that in front of me. But, yeah, he's toured the United States. He's lectured. He's totally rejected, of course, you know, by me.
Of course, yeah. But it's really interesting because I've heard some terrible stories about how difficult it is to get rid of Candida. But it sounds like it doesn't have to be quite that difficult. It sounds like... Well, you tell us, but I'm thinking of like baking soda and stuff. I'm like, well, maybe we can do it in the kitchen, huh?
Yeah, the cure is in the cupboard.
Yeah.
Actually, Cass Igrum wrote the book, The Cure in the Cupboard, about oregano oil. That's actually the title of a book. He was a DO that I knew in Milwaukee.
Oregano oil is outrageously helpful, isn't it?
It is. It's antifungal. It's antibacterial, et cetera. But again, even with the herbs, you can overdo them, and you can kill beneficials too. You know, they're often not as selective as we would hope they would be, but they're not as caustic or as drastic as antibiotics or anything like that. But you want to be, you know, conscious of the fact that even when you're taking oregano or garlic or something that would be is you know antimicrobial, that you could run into problems with that too if you overdo it. But it's hard to overdo that compared to antibiotics. But yeast is insidious. One, you know, like it has a life cycle. It has a strong tendency to, you know, procreate and proliferate and do what it does.
But it needs to be fed, doesn't it? I mean, so can't you starve it?
Yes. Well, when it gets to yeast therapy, you hit it right on the head. The number one thing is you must starve it out. That will not necessarily eradicate it, but it will weaken it, and it will put it into like a more of a dormant level of activity. But if you don't starve yeast, I don't care what medications you use or what herbs you're taking, because there are natural substances that are antifungal as well, but you have to weaken the situation with a diet that's carbohydrate restricted. Preferably less than 50 grams of carb a day, but certainly no more than 100 grams of carbohydrate a day. If you read Dr. Crook's book, The Yeast Connection, that was the classic that came out in the 80s, and he kind of set the tone because as a physician, he noticed that these yeast problems were just becoming tremendously prevalent in his practice.
And people made fun of him.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, you know, like Emerson said, if everybody thinks you're crazy, you're probably headed in the right direction. So, yeah, Crook took it, but now of course he's revered, you know, in alternative circles, and more MDs that aren't alternative are kind of, you know, becoming more aware of this subject. And that was followed by many books on yeast, and they were all pretty good. But some of the diets were so strict that people, you know, struggle to comply with the diet.
Yeah, that's the part I'm trying to address here for people. That it is possible. Well, first of all, doesn't the Candida yeast exist in all of us anyway?
No, not Candida. Candida is a pathogen. There is no place for Candida, or Candida is the correct pronunciation, but everybody says Candida, but doctors don't like Candida. They like Candida.
Okay.
But yeah, there's no...
Excuse me.
There's no place for the human body for this type of yeast. There are probiotic yeasts, Saccharomyces boulardii being the classic one, and you can actually buy probiotic yeast products, Florastor being the most popular, is made in France, and it's even used in hospitals. It's a medical probiotic, it's used in hospitals to control C. diff, you know, Clostridium difficile, which is a, you know, problematic, highly resistant organism in, that the hospitals deal with quite regularly. Mm-hmm. And Florastor, F-L-O-R-A-S-T-O-R, sold in drugstores like Walgreens, whatever, and online, and some health stores, is a yeast probiotic. So there are yeast probiotic organisms that are very important, and I'm particularly fond of Florastor. I have found it to be a remarkably effective probiotic. And I don't really, you know, I don't know that it kills Candida, but it does seem to repel it. It does seem to replace it. And
sort
and,
of dominates it, maybe, huh?
Could be, yeah, could be. So it's, you know, there are yeast probiotic organisms and there are yeast probiotic products that you can buy that I have found to be very helpful. I like both bacterial probiotics and yeast probiotics. And those are your two classes, basically. You have, you know, beneficial bacteria and beneficial yeast. But no, there's no... you know, normal Candida level in the body.
Hmm.
It's become accepted because it's so common, and so doctors tend to ignore it, but technically it's a pathogen, and it has no function in the human body whatsoever. So,
and I've heard it can grow and take over your brain and everything. Is that right?
Well, you know, I don't know, actually. I've read those stories. I do know that if you actually find it in the blood, you'll only find it in the blood in people that are absolutely terminal.
Okay.
Severe, you know, terminal HIV situations, terminal cancer situations, where the immune system has become so run down that it can't keep yeast out of the blood, and you could literally culture yeast in the blood. That's an absolutely terminal condition.
Hmm.
Now, live cell microscopists, dark field live cell microscopy, when you look at a living blood under the microscope, they claim that they can see yeast and fungus in the blood, but that's actually never been proven per se.
Hmm.
I don't doubt that there can certainly be influence in the quality of the blood, but I don't know that you would actually find the yeast per se in the blood. You're getting into an area here which is still under consideration, under investigation, hasn't really been determined.
Okay.
But there are practitioners that say there's yeast in the blood, and well, maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but there's certainly yeast in the gut when it's in the gut, and it can get into the tissues for sure. And that's, you know, like Simoncini said, the cancer tumors are loaded with fungus.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
So if a person starts to do the Candida diet.
Candida's fine. Everybody calls it Candida now, of course.
But they can usually, yeah, it's a living language, isn't it?
It is a living language.
Usually people can tell fairly quickly, can't they, when they've removed some of it?
Yes. I mean, so you starve it out, getting back to the, you know, the therapy here. Got to get on a low carbohydrate diet because it's the only food it can metabolize. You starve it out, and then you go in and you try to eradicate it. From a natural perspective, caprylic acid, which is extracted from coconut, has a really good effect in that regard. Garlic, strong garlic, like the Pharmax garlic freeze-dried, is the most potent garlic I've ever worked with. It's excellent. It's very antifungal. Oregano is excellent antifungal. Pau d'Arco, and a lot of companies combine these in products like Yeast Fighters by Twin Lab or different, you know, yeast products, yeast multiples that combine these eradicators, so to speak.
So if you kept on that all your life off and on and tried to watch your diet, it would be all right?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
If you kept on that, you know, long term, on those like the garlic and the yeast fighters and so on, you could just keep it at bay? Is that it?
Well, you could resolve it. You could cure the situation if you stayed with it long enough. Absolutely, and it is a long-term process.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to starve it and then treat it, and be prepared to be in it for the long haul. Because don't expect you can expect quick results as far as improvement, and you know noticeable results. But it's going to take quite a while. I would say it's a year therapy to really, truly eradicate an existing yeast situation in the body.
So it's really like changing your lifestyle, isn't it?
Totally. Well, changing your diet to 50 or 100 carbs a day is a radical lifestyle change for most people. I mean, a potato, an average potato, has got, what, 40 carbs? Slice of bread has like 30 carbs, depending upon exactly the bread and the size and things like that. So it doesn't take much to get up to 50 or 100 carbs.
Hmm.
And that's a radical lifestyle change, you know, for sure.
Hmm.
Sugar, of course, there's nothing yeast loves better than a refined carbohydrate like sugar, or even agave, you know, which is real popular, honey. I mean, the yeast isn't too particular. It doesn't mind what kind of carb it gets, and the more refined it is, the better. So you really have to be strict with your diet in order to do this type of work. Now, there are medications. Nystatin, N-Y-S-T-A-T-I-N, has been on the market forever. And it kills guts. It kills yeast in the gut only. It's not absorbed, so it doesn't have any systemic effect, but it's quite effective. Especially the powdered nystatins. The tableted nystatins, I've never really been impressed, but the powdered nystatins, and Paddock is a company, P-A-D-D-O-C-K.
Well, you know, I've never taken that, but the people that I know that have say it's really hard. It's really hard on you.
It varies. Some people, you know, are even allergic to it, but that's pretty unusual. But the die-off, see, when you take something that's really aggressively killing yeast, you're going to have what they call a Herxheimer reaction or a die-off, where the body has to process the waste produced by the eradication of the organism.
Mm.
And so that's typically, yeah, you can kind of gauge the Herx, as they call it, the die-off process. You can kind of gauge that by your dosages. And you can modify that pretty quickly by adjusting dosages, but you're going to go through a die-off process, which could last for days to weeks.
Well, what does that mean? Does that mean like diarrhea or skin problems or
not typically.
Burping?
It would be possible that you could have some gut response, but typically it's just feeling terrible, feeling even worse than you did before, feeling flu-like, because, you know, yeast causes that brain fog and inability to concentrate and depression and things like that. And when the die-off hits, it tends to exaggerate those symptoms, flu-like, et cetera. But that'll pass if you stay with it. And employing various detoxification techniques, you know, and that would include even enemas or colonics and you know, really strict diet, lots of fiber. You know, you can do, bentonite clay baths and different things to try to help you with the detox process. And they can be very effective, but you're still going to have to go through it. You're still going to, you have a process to work through here to get rid of all that yeast in the system for sure. So it's involved, but it's, I should also mention another medication before I forget, Diflucan, now sold generically as fluconazole. And Diflucan, when it was really introduced initially, it was for HIV people because AIDS patients are all dealing with yeast infection. There's no exception. I mean,
okay.
It's, you know, HIV AIDS cases are just chronically infected bacterially and virally and fungal and that kind of a situation. And
everything's
out of
control.
It was a remarkable drug because it cleared yeast systemically. And it was the rage of the alternative medical community. Doctors loved it. We had doctors in our office that used it extensively. And, I mean, one tablet would take care of a vaginal yeast infection, for example.
What's it called, Flucan?
It's called Diflucan, D-I, D as in David, I, S as in Frank, L-U, C as in Charlie, A-N as in Nancy, Diflucan. And then after 17 years, it became a generic, and now it doesn't work. So, fluconazole, I don't even bother with it. The generic is F-L-U-C-O-N-A-Z-O-L-E. It just doesn't work, you know, generic.
Is that because they fixed it up?
Well, you know, first of all, if you really investigate generics, you realize they don't have to be full potency. I think it's
right.
80%.
Okay.
And then on top of that, they're not really tested when they come in from wherever they're made. You know, overseas, they're almost all made in different countries all over the world. And really, this whole generic crisis that we're in the midst of in our country, which is getting no publicity, was brought to the point about a year ago, or maybe it was 2 years ago, when heparin, which is an anticoagulant, was made in China. It killed a bunch of people. It was a bad batch. It was poisoned. A bunch of people were hospitalized. And, you know, but generics are just not the quality of the brand name. And I ran into this with parasite therapy because in our clinic and in my practice, we do a lot of parasite therapy. So many ill people. And by the way, there are certain parasites associated with depression and schizophrenia and things of that nature.
Yeah, I want you to talk about that. That's pretty important.
Yeah, Balanitidium coli. I learned that from Dr. Dahl, who was the Army's parasitologist as a colonel in the Medical Army Corps for 30 years. And our clinic did tests with her for 10 years when she had a private practice on the side before she retired in 95. And every so often I'd see this rare, unusual parasite, and Balanitidium coli, and I'd call her, and Dr. Dahl said, yeah, that's what the people in the crazy houses have, you know. And she was,
Oh, really? Now that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So, you know, organisms, yeast is a pathogen, candida is a pathogen. You know, there are parasites that are pathogenic. You know, they have their life cycle. And another thing about parasites, particularly large parasites like roundworm or tapeworm, et cetera, is that they secrete waste. And this waste, you know, they eat and they secrete waste. And this waste is absorbed into the body. And, you know, nobody can really assess the consequence of that on the body as far as the mental being and the physical being, for that matter, and brain chemistry. So these are unknowns. But some parasites are known to be associated with mental disorders.
Huh.
Yeast for sure is a factor. The thyroid's a huge factor. The high calcium that I see in hair analysis, particularly when it's associated with a low potassium and a low phosphorus, and a low magnesium, is like, you know, a very significant indicator that really needs to be corrected if you're really going to have good, healthy mental function and good thyroid function.
So when people are in mental hospitals, they're very rarely tested for these things, are they?
They're never tested at all.
Yeah, and they live on coffee and donuts. I'm kind of exaggerating, but they live on pretty
well. Well, it may not even be that exaggerated because there's really no investigation going on. This is just basically coping and, you know, managing people and, you know, maintaining a level of comfort, which is fine, but it's not clinical. You know, there's really no investigation into what's going on and why the person's in the state they're in. And I don't mean that as a criticism. I'm just saying that most of these facilities are just care facilities, and they're not mm-hmm. designed to be more than that.
Keep everybody in line. I remember teaching my stepdaughter when she was about 13. She was very, very small and stuff. And I said, when you're looking at a big, cranky man, remember, he just needs a good poop. And she's she's in her 40s now, and she still chuckles about that because it's true, right? And it can be true when people are crazy, as you called it, you know.
Yeah, I don't like to use that term, but I mean,
but you know what I'm saying. It's like, yeah, it's really pretty interesting stuff that it could be a very pivotal thing to learn, you know.
There is clearly a biochemical foundation to these situations, and it's for the most part ignored, you know. You know, just basically the symptoms are treated with antidepressants, or the symptoms are treated with antipsychotics, or, you know, benzodiazepines, you know, the anxiety, Valium class of medications, and they're just basically treating symptoms, which is fine. It's typical, and the drug companies love it because it's super profitable. But
when I think of people who have road rage or people that go and shoot everybody up and that sort of thing, I just keep wondering what – I know it's biochemical, and I know there's something in their gut. You just know it, right?
I do.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, that's a very important subject, isn't it?
I think it is, and it's an epidemic in our culture. I mean, if you look at the number of people that are taking various antidepressant medications and antipsychotic drugs and, you know, anti-anxiety drugs and whatever, it's enormous. It's an absolutely huge number of people. What a market. And we're just not educated. I mean, you can go through the whole educational system in the United States, you know, high school, college, even advanced, and learn nothing about your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I work with women all the time who don't know anything about their menstrual cycle, don't have a clue about fertility cycles or ovulation cycles. This is all such simple, basic stuff. You know, and then that takes us into the but it's not taught. So, you know. But that takes us into the hormonal. We talked about thyroid. Well, that's a hormone. That's obviously a factor here. It's not a steroid, but when you look at steroid hormones like estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, cortisone, whatever, they're huge players in the condition we're talking about here, mental health, absolutely huge. Women are easier to talk about in this regard simply because their cycles, their hormones are so more self-evident.
Mm-hmm.
But how many women are dealing with, like, PMS, you know, premenstrual syndrome, that goes on for weeks before their cycle, or, you know, and they're absolutely miserable. They're struggling with all sorts of emotions, and they're breaking down in tears, and they're having all sorts of symptoms, which are legitimate symptoms that are pretty much ignored, and they have major irregular hormone, steroid hormone imbalances. Interesting that all your steroid hormones are made from cholesterol. Interesting.
Now that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. All your steroids are made from cholesterol. Cholesterol is a sterol, cholesterol from which steroids are made.
Bring in the niacin.
What's that?
I said, bring in the niacin.
And it's not like too much cholesterol is a problem. It's too little cholesterol for brain health, and because the brain needs a lot of cholesterol, uses a lot of cholesterol. In fact, every cell in the body, the cell membrane, is a lipid sandwich, protein sandwich between lipid layers. And a healthy cell membrane must be 50% cholesterol at least.
Yeah.
The liver makes cholesterol whether we eat it or not. It's absolutely essential in our bodies, and it's a raw material extraordinaire. It's not a bad thing. Once you have plaque, it's an issue because it can certainly contribute to clotting, excessive cholesterol, but it doesn't cause plaque. Plaque is caused by bacteria, just like plaque in the mouth is caused by bacteria.
That's fascinating.
This has been proven in Scandinavia. They've actually isolated the bacteria that causes heart disease and causes the plaque. Plaque just doesn't occur. And it's interesting because in the medical model, they say, well, macrophages, you know, LDL, the undesirable cholesterol, but that's actually the cholesterol you make your hormones from, LDL, and all your cell repair maintenance, the cells that, you know, use cholesterol, it's all LDL. You know, LDL gets oxidized, and then macrophages appear. Well, macrophages don't appear because something's been oxidized. Macrophages are like this, one of the strongest white cells made by the immune system to fight infection. And so the reason the macrophages appear is because you've got infectious organisms laying down plaque in your arteries.
Hmm.
Again, I know we're digressing into another subject here, but they're all interrelated.
Yeah, I was going to say they are all related, aren't they? I'm going to go back to cholesterol. Do you think that encouraging the higher healthy cholesterol is better for mental health? That's my...
You mean the high density, the HDL cholesterol?
Yeah.
I don't know that that's a fact. It's an interesting thought, though. It could be. I've never seen anything on it, and I don't have any direct experience with that, so I don't know. But there's, you know, HDL is considered to be basically completely beneficial. There's actually two types of HDL. One is considered more beneficial than the other, but it's definitely a favorable thing in the body. And by the way, cholesterol is the substance from which vitamin D is synthesized in the body.
Really?
Yeah. Well, so when sunlight interacts with your skin, it interacts with cholesterol and in the beneath the skin, and it forms vitamin D. Yeah. That's why the name for vitamin D, the technical name, actually implies cholesterol. So basically, vitamin D, which is super important for mental health and brain health. And hey, everybody perks up when the sun comes out.
That's true, isn't it?
We haven't had any sun here for a while, so it's, I'll have to wait and see if it happens again.
Well, it's trying to kind of poke out right now. We're watching the sky be a little bit interesting here.
Yeah. So, I mean, sunlight and vitamin D are crucial for I do a lot of vitamin D blood tests, and virtually everybody's low in vitamin D. I mean, I would say that easily 80% of the blood tests I see are low or borderline low in vitamin D. And the range is big. It's 30 to 100.
Is that just here in the Northwest where we get a lot of rain, or is it just generally like in Hawaii?
Generally, because my practice, as you know, by phone is all across the United States. So I work with people in Florida who are low in vitamin D, California. It's sunlight is there, but we're living behind glass. And the ultraviolet B, which is what generates the vitamin D, doesn't exist once it's filtered through glass.
Well, what do you think about the ozone layers and the danger of being in the sun?
I think you got to be smart, and you got to modify, and you got to be cautious with wearing hats and clothes. You don't want to burn. I'm not recommending that people go out and get burned by the sun, but you want to get sun exposure, and you want to be in a swimsuit. You want to get full body sun exposure.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, melanoma, which is the only skin cancer that is actually fatal or really serious, occurs almost always, I would say upwards to 80% of the time, in a part of the body gets little or no sunlight. Once in a while, you'll hear about it on the face or, you know, Aries shoulder, wherever gets a lot of sunlight, but usually not. That's not the case.
How does that work? Why is that?
Well, the whole idea that sunlight is the cause of skin cancer has actually never been proven. I mean, it's theorized, and it makes certain logical sense. But vitamin D is actually an anti-carcinogen. It's a profound anti-carcinogen.
Mm-hmm.
And with all these chemicals people are putting on their skin to block the sunlight, look at the ingredients. There's carcinogenic ingredients in there. You could literally draw a chart that graphs the increase in skin cancers in the United States that literally parallels the increase in the use of sunblockers.
That's so interesting. Well, tell me about coconut oil. Is that a really good thing for the skin?
Oh, it's not only good for the skin, it's great for the brain.
Okay.
And I know Alzheimer's wasn't on our subject here today. Of course, we go all over the place anyway.
Yeah.
But coconut oil is known to be therapeutic in dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia. There's actually a video on YouTube that you can look if you search coconut oil and Alzheimer's disease by a physician, a woman physician whose husband had severe Alzheimer's and was totally failed his cognitive tests and everything. And she thought, you know, this amyloid plaque and all this stuff in the brain that's associated with Alzheimer's, okay. But the physiological consequence is that the brain can no longer metabolize glucose. I mean, the brain is the biggest user of glucose in the body. It's a voracious appetite for glucose. But it's fully capable of metabolizing ketones. And that's why the ketogenic diet is used to control seizures with tremendous success, where you actually eat so few carbs that you make your body go into ketosis, which means burning fat for energy. And it cures key seizure disorders. And that was developed by Johns Hopkins in the 1920s.
Then
it was suppressed for years because, you know, there's no money in putting people on the ketogenic diet. Making a big comeback now. And this woman with her husband and the Alzheimer's, she said, you know, the brain can metabolize ketones. So she, you know, restricts his carbs and puts him on, like, I think 3 or 4 tablespoons of coconut oil a day, and he starts to improve. And
wow, what a great story.
I think in 3 or 4 months he was passing cognitive tests.
Oh, my, what a wonderful, wonderful story. So if we slather our skin with coconut oil, that will help us integrate the vitamin D, and it'll be good for our absorption anyway, right?
Well, I don't know about coconut oil on the skin is wonderful. Mm-hmm. There's no cholesterol in it, so I don't believe it's going to help metabolize vitamin D, unless it does in a way that I'm not familiar with. Coconut oil is saturated, but it doesn't contain cholesterol. Cholesterol is only in animal products. There's no vegetable products that contain cholesterol, even though they may be saturated, like coconut oil or palm oil. So I don't know that coconut oil is going to actually enhance vitamin D, but it's going to feed the brain ketones, and it has to be taken orally. And those ketones are going to get in, and the brain's going to use ketones, especially if you restrict sugar, especially if you minimize the availability of sugar. And you maximize the availability of ketones. And, of course, the ultimate way of doing that is the ketogenic diet, which if you Google it, there's just tons of information on the keto.
That's K-E-T-O, right?
K-E-T-O, K-E-T-O, ketogenic, G-E-N-I-C, diet, ketogenic diet. And you put yourself into ketosis. Now, another little, caveat here around the subject is that cancer cells have a huge appetite for sugar, too. Everybody, knows that, not everybody, but it's pretty common knowledge that cancer cells love sugar, and consequently, they consume a lot of sugar. So if you pull the sugar out, if you really dramatically reduce and put the body in ketosis, you literally starve cancer cells.
Oh, wow.
Now, cancer cells are embryonic in their own unique way, and they can eventually adapt to that, but you can really interfere with the way they typically metabolize.
Wow. Well, you've given us a lot. We have to end this, unfortunately, or fortunately, so we can sit and digest all this.
Digest?
But you've given us so much to think about today. I'm just very, very pleased, and I thank you so much, Jim Emke. Do you want to tell people how to get hold of you?
Sure. My email address is just my last name, Emke, spelled E-H-M-K-E, the number 5 at AOL. Emke5, E-H-M-K-E, and my phone number is 360-734-9777.
Wow, you know so much. How do you, I guess your brain's pretty good. It just keeps learning more, doesn't it?
Well, I'm working on it. it's balancing that with the aging process, right?
Oh, yeah, but even coconut oil must help with that.
And I love coconut oil. I use it regularly. The only fats we have in our house are coconut oil, olive oil, and some butter.
That makes sense to me. Wow. Well, I'm going to go eat some coconut oil right now. Not that I have Alzheimer's, but, it keeps
it's
the brain.
It's good stuff. It's great. And, you make your hormones from saturated fats. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind. So all your cholesterol and your saturated fats, that's what you make hormones from. And it was a pleasure.
It was really a pleasure for me and to our listeners. Thank you so much, Jim Emke.
You're welcome, Veronica. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Wow, that was a real tour through how the body works and how to make yours work even better. We touched on a lot of different subjects, so thank you so much for listening. Let me know what you think of this. VeronicaEntwistle.com, and there's an Ask Veronica button, and you can say anything you want in there. Tell me what guests you would like to hear from or what comments you have about Jim Emke and how the body works. This is Veronica saying, and if you want a session with me and my guides and angels, this is Veronica saying thank you so much for listening. Many, many blessings and much love.